job down at the local mill. Work drive up 9 a million. I pay my bills. Repo man's at my door. The call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me wife, kids, a car and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it.
Folks, welcome to the February 6, 2010 hour brought to you with the Recorded Community Radio in Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and webcast live worldwide at weft.org. Views and opinions here are solely ours and do not represent necessarily those of the board of directors, station manager, etc., etc. Okay, and here's Tom with a few acknowledgments of our underwriters.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Illinois Job Coalition. Education Associates are proud to support the EFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. This hour of programming is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A Democratic Union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is hoped that all workers may share the same benefits early health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you, the listeners of WEFT, and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us, and later in the program, this week's edition of the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's brand new poem for this week, first heard live here on the Illinois World Labor Hour, will be an ode to J.D. Salinger. Also here with us today is co-host Bob Pelesny, our tech expert and advisor, who will have some news for us. So now let's get on with the show. Tom?
Democrats in both the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, after a year of contending with massive proposals to stimulate the economy and to revamp health care, appear to be making a new approach for 2010, that being smaller is better. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and numerous other Democrats are saying that they intend to spread out their efforts to address unemployment in a series of bills this year instead of one giant measure. And the House of Representatives is planning to start work this coming week on a single slice of health care legislation that has been stalled in Congress. Senators Charles Schumer, a Democrat from New York, and Orrin Hatch, a Republican from Utah, are co-sponsoring one provision of a jobs bill, that being a payroll tax break for businesses that hire unemployed workers. The jobs bill would also extend unemployment benefits for those whose benefits will run out and renews the subsidy for health insurance premiums under the COBRA program. Bob?
Okay. A federal U.S. judge ordered jet engine maker Pratt & Whitney to halt its plans to move 1,000 jobs out of Connecticut to Japan, Singapore, and the state of Georgia. U.S. District Judge Janet C. Hall in Bridgeport issued a permanent injunction stopping the company's plan to shift the jobs. The judge strongly criticized the subsidiary of United Technologies Corp., saying it evaded the spirit of its union contract requiring it to make every effort to keep the jobs in the state. The union, which represents about 3,700 workers, hailed the decision. In its lawsuit, the union accused Pratt & Whitney of failing to comply with the contract that required it to do everything possible to preserve the jobs. "This is a full win for the union," said James Parent, chief negotiator for the machinist local. Pratt & Whitney has been reeling from a downturn in the aerospace industry. They announced in September plans to shut its engine overhaul and repair plant in Cheshire by early 2011 and shift repair operations from its East Hartford facility beginning in the second quarter of this year. The union says its victory was only temporary because its contract with Pratt & Whitney expires in December. Dave?
Okay, shares of major U.S. defense contractors, or as I like to call them, war profiteers, rose on Monday after the Obama administration unveiled a defense budget for fiscal 2011 that seeks a 3.4% increase in the Pentagon's base budget and $159 million to fund missions in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Among big-name industry leader Lockheed Martin gained 37 cents, or a half percentage point, and $74.89, while aircraft maker Boeing rose 1.8% at $61.70 a share. Northrop Grumman, a provider of ships and unmanned spy planes, rose 2.3% to $57.92 a share. War is profitable, evidently.
Two manufacturing companies in Danville are experiencing a resurgence in the automotive business and are going to be hiring workers to meet the demand for the work. Danville's Alcoa facility in the Southgate Industrial Park near Lynch Road and Interstate 74 has been hiring back some of the workers it laid off a year ago. Also, ThyssenKrupp Presta, located at 75 Walls Creek Drive in Danville, is hiring workers for some new automotive work that has emerged. According to a spokesman for Alcoa, 2 weeks ago, the Danville Alcoa facility, which experienced layoffs 1 year ago, began issuing callbacks for 10 positions, bringing the total of number of employees back up to 27, including 22 hourly and 5 salaried employees. At one time, as many as 45 workers were employed at the Alcoa plant in Danville, but in December 2008, the number had been reduced to 23. ThyssenKrupp Presta is a supplier of automotive camshafts, steering shafts for Ford and Chrysler vehicles, and universal joints for the Dana Corporation. That business is rebounding nicely, and they are striving to get 30 positions filled to handle the new workload. So far, they've hired 10 operators, but still need an additional 20.
Okay, the giant Rio Tinto borax mine in Boron, California, locked out about 540 hourly workers Sunday after the employee union refused to ratify a new labor contract. The Boron, California operation is the largest open pit mine in California and the second largest borax mine on Earth. The Kern County community and the mine have been closely tied for generations, but increasing labor tensions have threatened to sever those bonds. Many residents work at the mine and fear a strike or extended lockout could cripple the city of 2,000 people. I think it will be pretty traumatic, said Jim Freeman, 54 years old, who has worked at the mine for 31 years. I think the company had the impression we were going to roll over and let them feed us the poison. Rio Tinto is a London-based mining giant with operations on five continents, has been negotiating with the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 30, which represents the employees since September. The company says that it lost 25% of its global borax share and needs to make changes to stay competitive. They say they're asking for a lot of changes, but they say employees should have some flexibility in that. Anyway, global unions are calling for international action against Rio Tinto after the lockout here. The Maritime Union of Australia says that our solidarity goes to the ILWU boron miners and their families in particular, whoever suffered these attacks on the morning of January 31st, for defending workers' rights and refusing to capitulate to the bullying tactics of Rio, whose agenda is to break the union in order to slash wages and conditions. The company posted profits of $3.7 billion last year. Rio Tinto hired vanloads of security guards to storm the mine while helicopters flew overhead only last October. It is a company that has been taken to task for abuses of human rights, indigenous land rights, workers' rights, and damage to the environment and local communities in Australia, Africa, Bougainville, Indonesia, Iceland, and evidently California.
Dave? Okay. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that they're represented by the ILWU. It's a pretty decent union and stuff. So,
yes.
But it always amazes me, these terms, flexibility. In other words, workers need to be more flexible, you know, so that the companies can make more profits and workers' standard of living lowered even more.
They were making $3.7 billion last year, and they offered the union a 2% wage increase.
Yeah. Okay, thousands of people marched in Brussels, Belgium on Friday in protest against the job-cutting plans of companies such as General Motors, Unit Opel, and beer maker Anheuser-Busch. Belgian workers from Opel Antwerp, which is set to close in June, the world's largest brewer, AB InBev, DHL, and Volkswagen's Audi, carried banners which read, "People first and profit, and we should not pay for the crisis." Police estimate the number of protesters at over 27,000. Unions expressed anger that hundreds of billions of euros, which would roughly come out to about 200 billions of U.S. dollars, were being spent worldwide to bail out banks rather than saving jobs and industry. The banks, which receive billions in aid, are dropping the companies. The banks must be at the service of the economy and not the other way around, said Rudy Deleuve, who heads the ABVV trade union. Delegation from Opel Antwerp led the march from the European Commission's headquarters to central Brussels, setting off pink smoke flares and shouting, "We are Opel and we want to work." It cannot be that factories in one European Union state are closed with the help of taxpayers' money in other European Union countries, and that production is then moved to Korea, Opel's European deputy labor leader Rudy Kenz told Reuters.
Under a new federal grant program, some public housing residents in Champaign-Urbana will be required to work towards self-sufficiency. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has announced that the Housing Authority of Champaign County is one of the three latest agencies to be chosen for the Moving to Work program, which is intended as an enhanced effort to help families living in public housing or receiving rent subsidy vouchers. The other two areas selected were programs at Orlando, Florida, and Tacoma, Washington. Some 30 housing authorities nationwide are already participating in the Moving to Work program, which allows housing agencies to design and test housing strategies to help lower-income families. The goals are to reduce cost and increase effectiveness, and to give incentives to families where the head of the household is working, seeking work, or getting job training or education, and to increase housing choices for lower-income families. Services offered are all based on the needs of the individual tenants and are designed to help them set and achieve goals to move towards self-sufficiency.
Okay, here's a local story out of the News Gazette. This is the Visiting Academic Professionals Association of Academic Professionals filed an unfair labor practice complaint Wednesday with the Illinois Educational Labor Relations Board. It alleges the university violated the state's Labor Act by failing to bargain for changes in employee notices of appointment and unilaterally imposing furloughs. The U of I announced last month that 11,000 employees would have to take unpaid days off before the end of the semester. 10 for top administrators and 4 for faculty and academic professionals who earn more than $30,000 a year. Later, the U of I said employees could take an equivalent pay cut instead of furlough days. The Academic Professionals Union signed its first 3-year contract with the university in 2006, and the two sides have been negotiating a new contract since the fall. Gene Vanderport, area representative for the Illinois Education Association, said the two sides did not come to any agreement on furloughs at a sidebar meeting Monday. The union represents about 300 employees who have short-term contracts, usually a year. Robin Kaler, a spokeswoman for the U of I, said, "We expressly recognize our obligation to bargain over the impact of the new policy. They didn't make any demands to bargain over the impact," Kaler said. "When the mandatory furloughs were announced in January, we shared it with the union immediately and offered to discuss it," she said. But Alan Belansky, chief negotiator for the union, said the union argued against the U of I's right to impose new working conditions at the time and received mixed messages about the university's willingness to bargain. As with other U of I unions, the contract for visiting academic professionals has no language addressing furloughs.
Okay. Okay. Well, this last week was the 50th anniversary of the lunch counter sit-ins in North Carolina. 50 years ago, 4 men stood up by sitting down. The 4 college freshmen walked quietly into a Greensboro dime store on a breezy Monday afternoon, bought a few items, and sat down at the whites-only lunch counter and sparked a wave of civil rights protests that changed America. Violating a social custom as rigid as law, Franklin McCain, Joseph McNeil, Ezell Blair, and David Richmond sat near an older white woman on the silver-backed stools at the F.W. Woolworth store. The black students had no need to talk. Theirs was a spontaneous act. Their actions on February 1st, 1960 were meticulously planned, down to buying a few school supplies and toiletries and keeping the receipts as proof that the lunch counter was the only part of the store where racial segregation still ruled. "The best feeling of my life," McCain said, "was sitting on that dumb stool. I felt so relieved," I felt so at peace and so self-accepted at that very moment. They weren't afraid, even though they had no way of knowing how the sit-in would end. What they didn't know was this: they were tired, they were angry, and they were ready to change the world. After that, the number of protesters mushroomed, reaching at least 1,000 by the fifth day. Within 2 months, sit-ins were occurring in 54 cities and 9 states. Within 6 months, the Greensboro Woolworth lunch counter was desegregated. Okay. Tom, you got any more news stories?
No, that was my last. I have my poem.
Okay. Yes. I want to let the listeners know that we got a special call-in guest today. His name is Cy Khan. He's a community and labor organizer that's been around quite a few years. In fact, he started his activism actually in the South during the civil rights movement and stuff. And he's going to be calling in about half past the hour here. It's interesting. Not only is Cy Khan a union organizer and community organizer, he's also a musician, labor troubadour, and he's written a new book. The name of it is Creative Community Organizing, A Guide for Rabble-Rousers, Activists, and Quiet Lovers of Justice. In this book, it has forewords by Angela Davis and Jim Hightower. So we're going to listen to one of Cy Khan's cuts off his newer CD, and then we're going to come back with the Cultural Corner and Tom's Poem of the Week and some very important public service announcements.
fox in the field. Can't hardly keep the plow from raking. I could be there riding all around these fields, boss of anything worth taking. Shotgun on my shoulder, whip in my hand, keep the mule in the front, the cropper on the land. On this old river, on this plantation, in this dark season, on this long night. Stones in the graveyard, rocks in the fence, surround the bones of those who bore me. I can see their faces rising up like questions all along the road before me. With nothing to count on but their hard-working hands, they were trampled like the cotton, broken like the land. On this old river, on this plantation, in this dark season, on this long night. What do you do when you're walking down the track? One train coming toward you, another at your back. What do you do when you're finally forced to choose? When either way you win, either way you lose. Stones in the pathway, rocks in the road, my friends and family have to travel. If I go with them, if I go against them, how will they speak my name tomorrow? All you can count on when your final crop comes in is the harvest that gets gathered by your neighbors and your kin. On this old river, on this plantation, in this dark season, on this long night. Even if you're broken, at least you won't be shamed. You know someday your children will be proud to say your name. On this old river, on this plantation, in this dark season, on this long night.
Okay, now we are at this time in the Illinois World Labor Hour for the Labor Hour Cultural Corner with Tom Thomas's poem of the week, an ode to J.D. Salinger.
Like a rainstorm to the desert come the children up to the rye, running, playing, laughing loudly, each underneath their summer sky. Innocence is overwhelming, saturating the rich green field, where the children play, unknowing how their fates will soon be sealed. Some will run and play forever, or till their bones get old and stiff, but some will not make it that far, because they will fall off that cliff. The cliff that drops beyond the field that oftentimes a child won't see, until they've gone over the edge and sailed into eternity. There was one who saw the problem, and Holden Caulfield was his name. Deciding to be a catcher was Holden's claim to lasting fame. His story has a moral truth, because he ran up into the rye to catch the children in danger so none would have to fall and die. That cliff is steep, with bottom dark, with never the promise of light. If any soul went over the edge, Holden just would not feel right. Salinger's stories birthed good dreams in millions of hearts in our world. Holden's all were some righteous schemes with flags of hope fully unfurled. Our thanks to J.D. Salinger for telling the story clearly and for being a champion of so many dreams we hold dearly. On January 27, 2010, Jerome David Salinger passed on at the age of 91 years. An ode to J.D. Salinger was written at the Poets' Loft in Champaign, Illinois on February 2, 2010, and was first recited live February 6, 2010 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. And we got some public service announcements here. This is from the Upstate New York Troy Area Central Labor Council from Mike Keenan. I just sent an email message to President Obama asking him to stand firm in opposing the Columbia Free Trade Agreement. On the campaign trail, candidate Obama pledged, quote, "I'll oppose the Colombian Free Trade Agreement because the violence against unions in Colombia would make a mockery of the very labor protections that we have insisted be included in these kinds of agreements," unquote. But in his recent State of the Union speech, sole mention of policy towards Latin America, President Obama suggested that he would now work to advance the stalled Colombia Free Trade Agreement. In so doing, the president basically contradicted his own campaign promises, majority opinion in the U.S., and the will of millions of Colombian farmers and indigenous people and unionists in Colombia. Help me remind President Obama that expanding NAFTA's destructive legacy is neither the change that he promised nor the change that Colombia needs. Please join me in Witness for Peace in sending a strong message to President Obama that we will not allow him to go back on his campaign promises. So make those phone calls and send those emails and write those letters to the White House.
Just wanted to remind folks, today is the first Saturday of February, and today is a peace demonstration, which will take place from 2 to 4 p.m. at the corner of Neal and Main and Church Streets in downtown Champaign. There are signs available for you to hold, or you can make your own sign and bring it and hold it up. That's today at 2 to 4 p.m. at the corner of Neal Street, Main Street, and Church in downtown Champaign.
That's the first Saturday of every month, I believe, isn't it?
First Saturday of every month, yeah.
Okay, yeah, they've been doing this since the invasion of Afghanistan. Of course, yeah. We remember back in those early dark days when they used to do it up on the North Prospect up near the Mallville, and all the right-wingers that came out and
beat up a guy.
An 85-year-old man, yes. Well, he tried to, but Bob fought back with his cane. I mean, oh, I miss Bob.
Yeah, I remember that.
But, yes, anyway, Bob?
There's a Haiti, an informational forum and fundraiser going on at the Ellis Campbell Alumni Center. That's at 601 South Lincoln in Urbana. That's going to be Thursday, February 11th from 7 to 9 p.m. That's for U of I students, faculty, and community members. And before this Valentine's Day weekend, CU Haiti Relief will present an informational forum, performance, and fundraiser for earthquake relief efforts in Haiti. Speakers with intimate knowledge of the country will share their experiences and perspectives on current events. Students will be given information on ways to participate in relief efforts. The evening will close with a musical performance by a to-be-determined ensemble. Specific speaker and musicians lineups is forthcoming. And the event is free and open to the public, although there will be a suggested donation for attendance, and all proceeds raised will go directly to Haitian Disaster Recovery. And once again, that's February 11th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Ellis Campbell Alumni Center, 601 South Lincoln in Urbana.
Okay, a call to remember the Charleston Five 10 years later. On the night of January 19th, 2000, South Carolina law enforcement agencies teamed up to send a military-style police force of 600 to attack a picket line of longshoremen at the port of Charleston, South Carolina, who were defending their union jobs against Nordana, a Danish shipping line. The police brutality against the International Longshoremen's Association Local 1422, a 98% African-American local, became a bloody war scene with many workers injured and hospitalized, including local President Ken Riley. Living up to the ugly legacy of the Old South, the right-wing Republican State's Attorney General Charles Condon, the former chairman of the George W. Bush for President campaign in South Carolina, returned reality on its head and charged the five victimized longshoremen, four black and one white, with conspiracy to riot felonies. A global and national solidarity movement to free the Charleston Five arose in response and became one of the most significant victories of our time. That victory provides valuable lessons for the challenges we face today. United labor community power, strategic action, and global solidarity were the components of the movement that beat back some of the most reactionary anti-union forces of the present day. International Longshoremen's Association, Charleston Locals, the South Carolina AFL-CIO, and Charleston Central Labor Council invite you to join them in a celebration of the 10th anniversary of this historic victory. The celebration with speakers, socializing, and tools for organizing will take place at the International Longshoremen's Association Local 1422 Union Hall, a center for labor, progressive activities, and community events for all kinds in Charleston. And if you can make it out to Charleston, South Carolina, this would probably be a very worthwhile event. Okay, we are coming up here towards the middle of the hour, and we're going to be expecting a phone call from Cy Khan here shortly. So what I think we'll do is we'll play another one of his... oh, I think that might be him. Hello,
Is this David?
Yeah, hello, you're on the air.
Hey, David, it's Cy Khan. How are you?
Good, Cy. I'm glad you could call today and everything. I've been really looking forward to this for some time.
Well, I've been looking... Hey, listen... anything that says World Labor Hour is my kind of show, David.
Okay, well, just for your information, we broadcast in about a 50-mile radius here in central Illinois, and then we also webcast worldwide live, and we have listeners as far away as Oakland, California, New York City, and even London, England. So hopefully a lot of them will be listening today. So,
well, I hope they are. You know, I got friends in all those places.
Okay, yeah, that doesn't surprise me. It sounds like you've been around quite a bit over the years, and I'll tell you, I'd like to maybe just get right into it here with some questions here. We had a story earlier about the 50th anniversary of the Greensboro, North Carolina Woolworth sit-down. At the lunch counter sit-downs and stuff, and I thought that was kind of appropriate considering this is kind of where you cut your teeth as an organizer during the Civil Rights Movement. Is that correct? Or?
Well, cut my teeth, cracked my teeth.
Cracked your teeth.
No, okay. You know, I am so proud to be from Charlotte, North Carolina, at least for the last 30 years.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, because one of the young men who sat in there in Greensboro was from Charlotte, and it's such an extraordinary tribute to the power of organizing, to the power of young people in leadership. The Civil Rights Revolution was really made by young people, you know, and we forget that Dr. King was 24 years old when he became the pastor in Montgomery and led the Montgomery bus boycott. You know, he was not the senior leader that we remember today. He was a really young activist. So, yeah, the fact that it's the 50th anniversary makes me feel really, really, really good.
Okay, and what motivated you to, I mean, kind of tell us a little bit about, you know, what you were doing at the time right before you decided to head down south. Because, you know, when that was all going on, I mean, it was pretty scary and dangerous stuff, wasn't it?
Well, it was scary. In fact, it was completely terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I would have gone south earlier, except my parents were also terrified. I had been involved. Right. I mean, you know, it's funny. I wrote in you know, I've got this new book. You know about the new book, right?
Oh, absolutely. We're going to talk about that later on.
Okay, great. So, but if it's interesting because of the process of writing this book that is a guide for, you know, rabble rousers and activists and quiet lovers of justice, as the subtitle says. I really went back through my own life as an organizer. I remembered all kinds of things that I had forgotten. And one of which was that I started getting involved in civil rights in my teens when I was in high school. I lived in Bethesda, Maryland, which was a segregated city. People forget that Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, in the 50s had black and white, actually they called them white and colored, drinking fountains within sight of the nation's capital. And Maryland was segregated as a state. It's a former slave state. And so I started by picketing the Woolworths, where because they refused to hire African Americans as cashiers. I picketed the Heiser Theater. I think there's now a sushi bar there, but because they had a balcony, because African Americans, black people, had to sit in the balcony, whereas white people got to sit downstairs. So I was involved in that when I was like 17 or 18. I wanted to go south so badly I could taste it. I mean, it just felt like the fulfillment of a dream. And my parents said, you'll get killed, right?
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were being old fogies, reactionary. You know, now at the age of 65 with, you know, three adult children, I think they actually had a very good point, right?
Yes, indeed. And was this before or after the three civil rights workers were killed?
Well, this was long before.
Okay.
I mean, this was probably like in 1959 that we were picketing in Bethesda. It came out of the very early Freedom Rides, which preceded Greensboro, when black and white activists rode buses into the South. Buses were segregated. African Americans had to sit in the back. And some very, very courageous activists decided to test that by getting on buses and going into and through the South. If you go to the quite extraordinary Civil Rights Museum in Birmingham, not the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, but the Birmingham one, there is the bus that was attacked and firebombed with the black and white activists on it in Anniston, Alabama in the early 50s is there. You see, it's still the smoke stains are still on the bus.
Oh, wow.
And you can imagine when, you know, the Klan and just the Southern whites hauled people out, beat them seriously. Some were permanently disabled.
Wow.
So there. I think we forget, with, I mean, all honor to the four young African Americans who sat in at Woolworths 50 years ago. All honor to them, but they didn't come out of nowhere.
Indeed,
movements don't come out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the movement for liberation of our African American sisters and brothers, the movement to abolish what really was apartheid in the United States of America, that starts way, way back. It has deep, deep, deep roots. And so I became active in the 50s. It wasn't until 1965 when I felt at the age of 21, I felt like I could make my own decision. And my mom told me years later, not that many years later, because she died quite young, but she said, you know, when you went south, I thought I would never see you alive again. And she meant that.
Wow. You know, you touched on an interesting point there. You know, as we're not taught this in schools, of course, and kind of a reference to that. Of course, last week, Howard Zinn died, the author of People's History of the United States.
And what a loss.
Oh,
and
indeed.
What a great life.
And what a trash job NPR did on him. But anyway, you know, that kind of leads into the question when you mentioned about these movements didn't come out of, you know, just came out of nowhere. You know, we never learned this in history class. Probably not even in most college classes, is what role historically is, you know, community organizing played in the U.S. Because really the civil rights movement, as grand as it was not the first example of this, was it?
No, you know, and I know we're here to talk about my book, but I want to recommend Vincent Harding's book, There Is a River. He's an African-American mm-hmm. theologian, and he does a wonderful tracking of the roots of the civil rights movement back to the moment when the first slaves hit the dock in Jamestown, Virginia, in 1619.
Oh, wow!
And yeah, so it's, and because there, you have the slave revolts, you have the abolitionists,
mm-hmm.
and by the way, you know, the labor movement is critical to the Southern civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
The great A. Philip Randolph, who
Indeed.
Was the president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters,
mm-hmm.
which was an African American led African American union,
mm-hmm.
was a major, major force. He was very, very influential with Dr. King, and. When I was in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was the student wing of the Southern Civil Rights Movement, I drove a wonderful three-quarter ton yellow Dodge four-on-the-floor pickup truck. It was donated by a United Auto Workers Union local in Detroit as their way of supporting the movement. So the labor movement, of which I am a proud, proud, proud part. I mean, I am union to the core, right? And I'm the organizing committee of my local, the American Federation of Musicians, and I've spent a lot of years with the mine workers, with the textile workers. The labor movement was critical to the success of the Southern Civil Rights Movement, and that's the way it should be. Our movement should be reinforcing, supporting each other.
You know, a lot of people get involved in various community and community organizing campaigns in general, or social justice campaigns. But you know, a lot of times there's a sort of a you talk about a role of self-interest in organizing, you know, some people might find that odd, but talk a little bit about that. I mean,
thanks, David. I mean, in the book, and I actually wish I'd written this a little bit more fully. I don't mean by self-interest something narrow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean like you're going to make money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
What I love about the struggle for justice is that you get to work with so many people who are motivated by a very broad humanistic self-interest. You know, I can't tell you how many coal miners, how many textile workers I have talked with when I say, why are you doing this? Why are you putting your job on the line, you know, risking everything you've got? They're like, I just want to leave a better world to my kids.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to leave a better world to everybody's kids. I can't stand it when I see people being pushed around. So to me, so the self-interest out of which organizing, whether it's union or civil rights or community organizing, springs, is that part of human beings that reaches out to others and that says, I want to leave something behind. I want to be remembered as somebody who did her best to make this world just a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's certainly my case. I'm not doing this for anybody else. I'm doing this for myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But, I mean, again, if somebody is doing it somewhat out of, I guess, cynically saying self-interest, I mean, what's wrong with somebody trying to get a better wage, get some health care, you know, try to improve their own lives and conditions overall for their community in general, as well as their children?
Well, that's leading the witness, David.
Yes.
No. You'd make a great lawyer. Listen, that's what I also work for. I mean, everyone in every country should have a living wage, should have good health care, should have the opportunity for education. And that's a self-interest that I could not support more. But, you know, this is not something you can do individually, and that's why we need organizing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say, I'm going to have, even though I'm making minimum wage, I am going to have a home of my own, and I'm going to have great health insurance. That can only be solved by policy changes. It can only be solved, mm-hmm. You know, you don't get higher wages. You can't say, isn't this great? You know, here I am working in this steel mill, and I'm making $48.52 an hour, and everybody else in the mill only makes $10. You know, the great Eugene Debs, president of the American Railway Union, once said, I will rise with my class, not above it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
And that's the principle of organizing. If you want higher wages and you're a mill worker, you're going to get them if you unionize. You're not going to get them if you just walk into the boss and say, could you double my wages and forget everybody else?
You know, of course, the corporate culture that controls most people's information and entertainment in this country, I mean, they don't, you know, they try to encourage individualism and, just completely ignore collectivism. And it's amazing how many workers out there think that the reason that we've got the, you know, halfway some laws like minimum wage laws or hours and, you know, work laws was because the employer just, gave them to us. And it's amazing how much that attitude is out there. And, of course, we both know that's far from the truth.
Well, no, I couldn't have said it better myself. You said it perfectly. But I think, David, your really important point here is that the corporations work unbelievably hard to make people believe, first, that you're gonna do best if you just do this on your own,
mm-hmm.
and that if you talk to other people, you know, you might lose your job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, I can't tell you how many organizing campaigns I've been in where, you know, the company in what we call, you know, but just for your listeners, what we call in the labor movement a captive audience meeting. That means that the company comes in and says everybody must come to this meeting, and then they show you some film made by some union busting attorney for $100,000. That talks about violence and the unions and the labor movement, you know, and all the myths about the labor movement.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll say, you know, this company is giving you Social Security. This company is giving you unemployment insurance.
Uh-huh.
This company is going to pay you time and a half after 60 hours. What's the union going to do for you? You know, neglecting the fact that the reason the company is paying Social Security is because in the 1930s, the labor movement made it our number one priority, and we fought to get Social Security. And if the companies could get out of it, they would.
Oh, indeed.
Right.
Indeed. Well, let's see. After the Civil Rights campaign down south, you went then to Harlan County, Kentucky. It was like in the early 70s and kind of worked with the United Mine Workers a bit. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I think, David, my life has been spent in the vacation hotspots of the world. You know? Forest City, Arkansas, Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina, Harlan County, Kentucky, you know? It's kind of like I'm kind of a movement travel guy, you know?
Uh-huh.
No, this is, I mean, I love the United Mine Workers. I'm still very, very close to them, and they've always been an extraordinarily progressive and forward-looking union in a really tough, tough, tough industry. So, I mean, what happened very, very briefly, and again, I know you know this history, but like you said, this does not get taught. In the 1960s, there was a very creative movement among coal miners, both working underground and disabled, against what's called black lung. It's a breathing disease that happens when you spend your life in very fine coal dust breathing it in. No surprise. And your lungs, there's a technical term called pneumoconiosis, which I practiced for days to be able to say like that. But everybody calls it black lung because actually, if you do an autopsy, your lungs have physically turned black.
Wow.
From the coal dust, the accumulation, and it kills you over time, but very slowly and painfully. And out of the black lung movement, this was a movement by rank-and-file miners, widows, orphans, disabled miners, and the United Mine Workers at the time was under very corrupt leadership and basically did absolutely nothing. And so ultimately, the miners also started a reform movement called Miners for Democracy and elected a slate of working miners to the chief officers of the United Mine Workers of America. I mean, real serious union democracy. And the strike in Harlan County, which was called the Brookside Strike, was the very first strike that this new working class leadership had to deal with. It was also a strike against the Duke Power Company in North Carolina. This is when we start to see the what we now call the energy companies, which we used to call electric companies. They started buying up coal and coal mines so that they could control the source of their own supply. And Duke was a very anti-union company. And unlike the rest of the coal industry, which had learned the lesson over the years that you were better off signing a contract with the mine workers than trying to take a strike, Duke was determined they wouldn't sign a contract. And my specialization as an organizer is worker-based corporate campaigns, right? There are a lot of ways of holding corporations accountable. I'm particularly interested in the ones where working people gain an understanding of how corporations work, and they are the ones that take the direct action. So I was brought in by friends of the mine workers to build that kind of a campaign out of a Harlan County base.
Well, gee, you know, the more I get to know you, the more I like you. I come out of the Carpenters Union originally, and, you know, a lot of people in the progressive labor community are very uncomfortable with rank-and-file movements for democracy. You know, there seems to be a lot of attitude of just, you know, support the union leadership no matter how much, how bad they are or how much they act like a corporation as opposed to a real union. So this is really, really inspiring. Another thing to really inspire me about your work and everything.
Well, thank you. You know, by the way, I was doing a concert in Santa Fe last Saturday night. First person showed up, Carpenter's Union jacket.
Oh, okay. Well, good.
You know, and that's my idea of a welcome. I don't need a bouquet of flowers.
Okay.
Just, you know, somebody shows up with a union badge.
Yes, okay.
But I'm with you, David. I mean, that the whole point of, you know, Peggy Sear, you know, a wonderful, wonderful artist, has a great song that says, if you've got a union, you've got to make it work for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe in union democracy. I mean, you know, in the old days, we used to call unions industrial democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's actually a really interesting phrase because it says that through labor, we create democracy in the workplace. But I, like you, believe that means that the people who are on the line, whether that means teachers or sanitation workers or, you know, or folks on the back of a dozer or whatever it is, that those are the ones who make the decisions. I think that nothing teaches democracy and the exercise of democracy like being a member of a strong democratic union. And don't let, you know, I think I like, you know, some folks who are progressive but uncomfortable. And I think a lot of it has to do with a failure to understand the level of self-education that so many working people have. I go back to my father's father's, Gabriel Kahn, who I don't think he ever went to school a day in his life, and escaped the Tsar's army. He actually deserted the Tsar's army and indentured himself to the Canadian Pacific Railroad. And he was a pick-and-shovel guy when they built the Canadian Pacific Railroad through the Ontario Shield in northern Ontario, and he was a hod carrier. People don't even know what that is today. A hod carrier, you put 100 pounds of bricks on a wooden board on your shoulder and you carry it up 10 flights of stairs. I mean, he did hard, back-breaking work, and he was an educated man, and he'd never been to school a day in his life. He read the papers, he listened to the radio, he had opinions about everything, you know, and what I believe is there's unbelievable wisdom in everyday people, and we just need to tap into it and trust it.
Yeah, you know, as far as the Harlan County, Kentucky strikes, of course, that's been well documented in not just print, but also in film as well. And,
people should, if you have not seen it, I know you have, but the film, the best film, is called Harlan County, USA, by Barbara Koppel, K-O-P-P-L-E, and it's as far as I know the only documentary about working people in the United States that won an Academy Award. It's a powerful, wonderful film. Our two older children, we have three adult children, have cameo appearances. There's a scene where there's a little kid in the coal camp chasing a football. That's our oldest son. And then in the tragic scene, after one of the strikers, Lawrence Jones, has been murdered on the picket line by a company security guard at the funeral, you know, there's the camera lingers on an infant in his mother's lap. That's our middle son, Jesse. He's now 38 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and by the way, there's as far as I know, the only documentary evidence that I own a suit and tie is in the picket line at the Duke Power Company, and I'm kind of keeping an eye on the picket line wearing a two-piece suit and tie, and it's because I'm going in to debate the company president.
Okay. Well, that kind of begs the question, does violence have any role to play in social change? Of course, you know, labor history is full of it. Of course, it's usually in self-defense against company thugs and local police. But, you know, that's anybody knows about labor history, or even the civil rights movement had its share as well. Could you comment a little bit about that?
Yeah, I believe that the only way we're really going to win is through nonviolent means. I think first I think violence is self-defeating in the face of the extraordinary power of the people against whom we fight. But I also really believe, just like I don't think you can build a democratic country or a democratic world by undemocratic means, which is why I believe in rank and file democracy. I think that violence begets violence. I think that's probably somewhere in the Bible. Sounds like it, doesn't it?
Indeed, yes.
And that now I want to be clear. I am for militancy. I mean, I'm for direct action. I'm for, you know, if you can stop the trucks, if you can stop the trains, if you can, you know, if we collectively throw ourselves against the wheels of production. I don't mean literally throw ourselves at the machines, but I absolutely believe it. You know, this is, by the way, a point that Gandhi kept making and that Dr. King kept making. They're like, I'm paraphrasing, this is what they said. They basically said, you know, don't think that nonviolence is for wimps. Nonviolence takes courage, it takes militancy, it takes direct action. It's not about being passive. But I think when we actually resort to physical violence, I think we both we lose some of our humanity, mm-hmm. and I don't think it helps us win strikes.
Yes, indeed. Well, it seems like in recent years you've been involved in various campaigns to help detained immigrant workers and this whole, the military-industrial prison complex, these private prisons. I mean, I was reading about the campaign to get some immigrant families freed from this privatized prison in Taylor, Texas. This is the most recent thing you've been working on, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm still working on it. Very, very, very involved with this whole question of, you know, privatization, which is, you know, I'm sorry that the word's so long, you know, because it doesn't, but what privatization means is that all these things that we paid for with our tax dollars, that we built with our hands, you know, what we sometimes call the public or the commons, and not to be mysterious, talking about like public schools, talking about parks, roads, bridges, ports, you know, the places where, by the way, lots of union workers work, right?
Mm-hmm.
That these are being given away or sold at a cheap price to these multinational corporations that then sell them back to us at a profit. And it's a disgraceful undermining of what we all hold in common. You know, we're pretty small shareholders, but, you know, I go to a national park. That's my national park, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's
indeed
not McDonald's national park.
Indeed.
But what's happening, but this is also, and this is, I think, a point that sometimes gets missed, that privatization is an assault on union workers and on union members. Because, and this is something I know a lot of your listeners know, that unionization is highest in the public sector in our country.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost twice what it is in the private sector. The public sector is, you know, government, you know, school teachers, you know, social workers, sanitation workers, road workers, and the people who work in prison. So when you privatize, you break the union. So I absolutely believe that the corporations like privatization, at least partly, because it helps destroy labor.
Oh, indeed.
So in all of this work, we're basically saying, keep it public, keep it ours, keep it union.
Okay, and we're kind of running out of time here, and there's just a couple more questions. I just got to get out here. I've been just itching to ask you here. This new CD you came out with, I mean, that was quite an interesting surprise that you're a songwriter and musician. And what was even more surprising when I came in here this morning to the radio station, as usual, a little early, the previous program, Airshifter, found three of your CDs, other CDs than what I had, that was your recent one, in our WFT music library. And so I think the oldest one here goes back to 1994, but you want to talk about the most recent one in your kind of career as a troubadour that we weren't aware of?
Oh, sure. You know, I am the official poet laureate of the North Carolina AFL-CIO by unanimous vote of the convention in 1985, and my CDs go back to LPs in 1975.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, absolutely. The new CD is called Courage, and it's my tribute to the quiet heroism of everyday people. You know, the way to find out about all of this is the website for the organization I work with. It's www.grassrootsleadership.org. And you can, you know, there's tools for organizing, there's music, there's all kinds of information to help people, you know, fight back against the power. So yeah, I've been and I am a proud member of Local 1000 and Local 342 of the American Federation of Musicians, AFL-CIO. I'm a union musician as well as a labor musician.
Wow, that's incredible. Listening to your most recent CD, it was one of my favorites on there was the Molly Maguire. I mean, that song has such power and passion to it, you know, describing what happened in, you know, in Pennsylvania with the hanging of the Molly Maguire union people and stuff. And, man, I'm of Irish descent, and I could have sworn you were Irish. I mean, the passion you put into that song.
You know, if we had more time, I'd explain why being Jewish and being Irish are almost the same. I got a whole theory about that.
Okay. I'd love to talk to you about that sometime. But moving on here real quick, you know, you made a kind of a reference to this earlier and about young people. I mean, you know, it seems like young people today, I have a 14-year-old daughter, and it's like it just doesn't seem like they've got the same focus on concern about the world and society we live in as, like, let's say, you know, someone like myself who basically grew up in the 1960s, you know, or someone like you who was an adult, a young adult in the 1960s. Can you comment on that?
Sure. You know, I mean, I think it's very mixed, but I will tell you that, I mean, the Grassroots Leadership's amazing campaign to close this for-profit private immigrant detention center where they had two-year-olds and six-year-olds and teenagers in cells with their parents, right? Appalling. That campaign was conceived of, organized, and run by two people in their early 20s. I work every day with people in their teens, in their 20s. It's a wonderful generation. That doesn't mean that every member of it is an activist, but that wasn't true in the 60s either. It was a much smaller hardcore. You know, most people were just going about their lives. There is a challenge for all of us in working with people younger than ourselves and with people older than ourselves. Anybody who is less politically experienced, and, you know, in my new book, which is called Creative Community Organizing, a guide for rabble rousers, activists, and quiet lovers of justice, I talk about, you know, how you work with people to help them come to a different level of consciousness. It's not just about saying you need to know this. There are ways of doing this to help people draw on the experiences they themselves have had, but interpret them in a political way. But it's quiet stuff. It's not. It doesn't happen overnight. But I'll tell you what. Anybody out there that's, you know, a young person and listening, I'm just going to tell you that this is the best generation of young people in terms of activism we've ever seen.
Oh, that's great. That's really encouraging for me. You know, I was kind of, how should I say, talking about my daughter's disappointment of lack of activism. But you know what? This is what I've pretty much given up on her. She'll surprise me now and then with not just her insight, and but also her analysis occasionally, and even occasionally something she did at school that surprised
me. Well, I mean, and I think it's like, I mean, it's like with any organizing, with any political education, with any labor or civil rights education, you know, like what's the song? You can't hurry love.
No, okay.
It's like that, and you know, part of what it means to be an activist is to learn radical patience. Radical patience.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, I tell you know, I with a lot of my coworkers, we talked yesterday to 25 social work students at the University of Texas in Austin. That's where I am right now. And you know, you don't dump the whole load on them. You just and I always say, I don't expect you to agree with me today, but just remember what I said. Because 15 years from now, you know, you may be losing your job, you may be being sexually harassed, you may be subject to some kind of racial discrimination. And remember, there was this guy that you thought was crazy who said, "Don't go to the boss until you've talked to the people who are working side by side. Don't, you know." Before you start bailing the boat, look out and see who else is in the boat with you.
That's great advice, and I just want to mention that your new book, Creative Community Organizing, has forewords by Angela Davis and Jim Hightower, two people I really admire. And where can people get a copy of your book?
You know, you can get it just about anywhere. I encourage people, first, you can get it from the Grassroots Leadership website, grassrootsleadership.org. You can get it from union bookstores like Powell's in Portland. It is up on Amazon, but you know, I really think, you know, what I would prefer people to do is just go to your local independent bookstore, the publisher Barrett Kohler will do very fine discounts for, like, you know, for unions and community organizations, and you know, that's I'm happy people can get it for less and get it out to more people.
Yes. Okay. Great. Well,
it's out there on all the sources. You can, you know, the very publisher is getting very good internet distribution.
So if you want the convenience of the internet, people use PALS, Amazon. If you real pleasure. Thank you so much,
David,
for calling.
Hey, David, great. Are you guys hit by the snow?
Oh yeah, we got about I'd say 4 inches or so last night. Listen, I really like to get you here to Champaign Urbana sometime in the future.
Listen, I'd love to get up there. You know, I've only been there once in my life, like 35 years ago,
Time.
It was.
Yes, indeed.
But I would love to come there. Thank you so much for what you do.
Yes, thank you. Okay, we're going to leave you with a song, The Molly Maguire by Cy Khan here. And thanks, Cy, for calling again. And we'll see you next week on the Illinois Labor Hour. Stay tuned for Close to the Fire.
Out in darkness, down at the breaker, close on the midnight hour. Steadily working, quietly leaving, trailing a thin line of powder. The little Schuylkill Valley tan is all lit up tonight by flames that lick like tongues from the breaker fire. The tight-lipped coal and iron police won't get much sleep tonight, looking for the sons of Molly Maguire.